So I thought it would be fitting just to set aside 30, 40 minutes, chat about this idea of the rapture. Is it biblical? Is it not? Is it somewhere in the middle? Is it neutral? Is it dangerous? Whatever, how I read it. I'm not speaking on behalf of the elders of our church. I'm just talking, okay? And then to have a little bit of time for Q&A. So first off, how many of you grew up in a church where the rapture was a thing? That's why you're here. That's awesome. How many of you have like scarring theologically? And so, yeah, okay, I'm here. So it's therapy after. How many of you grew up in a church where the rapture was not only a thing, but it was like black and white, like in the Bible, no question about it. If you don't believe in the rapture, you're like dangerous. Yeah, about the same number of people, which is a little bit interesting, not quite as many. So for those of you that did not, and you're just here out of curiosity or whatever, I'm just gonna do a quick overview. So this up here, and my writing is horrible, none of you can see this anyway, but the rapture is at the center of a way of reading the Bible, and this kind of way of reading the Bible as a whole, I don't have time to get into all of that, and to thinking about the future in particular, is called pre-trib premillennialism. And this is basically how they see the future. To clarify, I don't agree with this, but this is how they see it. So right now, if you were to chart out the future, we live in the present time, and the world is getting worse and 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 worse. This is fueled by modern media, where we now have more access to negative rhetoric about the world than ever before. So we know everything horrible that's going on in the world at any given moment, and the news media, for what better or worse, feeds off of violence and injustice and scandal and controversy and celebrities. Okay. Rather than off of justice and nonprofits and beauty and redemption. So there's this impression that the world is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And then at some point, it will get so bad that right before there's basically a self-implosion of planet Earth, Jesus will come in what is called the rapture. More on that name in a minute. And this is basically off of 1 Thessalonians 4. We'll get to that later, where Jesus comes in the clouds. So they would say halfway between heaven and earth, there's a trumpet. This is like the symbol of the end of history. And we are raptured, or we are caught up to be with Jesus in the sky. We, and we being followers of Jesus, we then go with Jesus back to heaven, where we stay there for 7 years, and there is a literal 7-year tribulation on earth where God pours out his wrath on all of mankind, and it's like every Michael Bay movie you've ever seen all put together. And so it's World War III or IV or whatever it is by then, and nuclear holocaust, and it's horrific, and it's all based on a literal reading of the book of Revelation, in particular Revelation, I think it's chapter 6 through chapter 18. Then at the end of the 7-year tribulation, 2/3 of Israel, and by that they mean ethnic Israel, are killed. There's barely anything left, and right before it's just about done, Jesus comes back in what we would call the second coming, which I very much believe in this part. Jesus comes back, this time with the church who is with him in heaven, and he returns and he rules and reigns from Jerusalem for a 1,000-year time period, they would say. This is called the millennium. It's based on Revelation 19, where we read about 1,000 years of Jesus ruling over the earth. And at the end of that, and this is the short version, Satan is set free from the pit. There is Armageddon. This is where this word comes from. There is a global war, cosmic war between Satan and his demons and human beings who do not want to live under Jesus' rule, and they lose. And Satan ends up in hell along with the demons. And this is, at this point, judgment. And it is usually, not always, thought of as the end of the time-space universe. So the world that you're in now is destroyed in the sense of destroyed, gone no more. Then in Revelation 21 and 22, we read about what Revelation calls the new heavens and the new earth, but usually, not always, in pre-trib, premillennial eschatology, they would simply talk about it or think about it in heaven in the more classic Western European sense of the word. So this is basically the framework that we're getting into. And if I lost you at about here, I'm sorry. Now, the word rapture is not a word that's used anywhere in the Bible. It's actually from the Latin raptus, and it simply means to be caught up or to be snatched away. And it's this idea that right before this horrific, evil, hard time of tribulation, that followers of Jesus are caught up to heaven to escape God's wrath. Now, one of the first questions, now I want to move on to origin. One of the first questions you should always ask with any doctrine, in particular if there's a controversial doctrine, is where the heck did this thing come from? That for me is incredibly helpful. So if, you know, so-and-so says this, John Mark says this, Mark Driscoll says that, your professor at seminary says this, and everybody disagrees, one of the best ways to kind of get at it is think, okay, where did this thing come from? Is this ancient? Is this historic? Has it ebbed and flowed through history? So let's talk about that from the rapture. The rapture is about 100, and I'm bad at math, what is it, 180 years old? So prior to 1830, nobody had ever used the word, nobody had ever thought of this idea ever before. In the 19th century, in particular in the British Isles and in Ireland, there was a growing interest in what's now called dispensationalism, which is this whole way of reading the Bible I don't have time to get into. And there was a fascination with the second coming of Christ and a sense that it's really, really soon, which 180 years later, they were a tad off, but there was this, and some of that's healthy, like a sense that Jesus is coming back. That's a really, I hope that we all have that today and don't overreact. So in this movement, there was a prayer meeting in Ireland in 1830, a charismatic kind of circle of the church, and there was a prophetic word about a secret rapture and how followers of Jesus would be caught up to heaven. And this was a brand new revelation. Now, anytime that somebody, after the church has been around for about 2 millennia, says brand new revelation, all of the red lights on your dashboard should be blinking, okay? That doesn't necessarily mean it's a false teaching, but it means the odds are not in its favor. When nobody's ever said this or thought of this for upwards of 2,000 years in the history of Jesus and his people, then you start to get, in my opinion, into dangerous ground. Now, the idea never took root in Europe. The Brits all think were ridiculous for ever entertaining this idea. But it did take root in America, in particular through a dude named John Darby, who was a well-known popular dispensationalist. And then it was put in the Scofield Reference Bible, which is kind of like the first study Bible ever. And that's where it was popularized at an American level. And then in the 70s, the late great Planet Earth was published by Hal Lindsey out of California. That was hugely popular. And then in the 90s, Left Behind, some of you were around, and now we're finally making a movie. Awesome. Thank you, Nicolas Cage. In the 90s, Left Behind was published. It's now sold 60 million copies right after Loveology. It's just hanging in there. So if you were born like I was on the West Coast, in evangelicalism, and I grew up in a soft dispensational church and then spent some time with Calvert Chapel, which is hyper-dispensational, or really, really into this. And it's really easy to think that the rapture is like everybody believes this. But once you get off of the West Coast, or maybe the Southern kind of Bible Belt, once you get out of like 1970 to about, 10 years ago, and once you step out internationally, this is not what people think. This is not where the majority of the world is at globally right now, and definitely not historically. This is really a brand new way of thinking about the Bible. Now, that said, I just want to walk through next the two passages where this comes from. So most, as I read it, and I've spent a ton of time reading this because I was in churches like this for years, and I've even taught this before, all right? And just forgive me for that. So most of the good kind of teachers would be open and honest that there are only two passages in the entire New Testament that explicitly, they would argue, teach a rapture. They would say there are some others that are implicit, and some would add a third to this one, 1 Corinthians 15, but most would just say two. So I'm just going to really fast walk you through these two passages. 1 Thessalonians, if you have a Bible, chapter 4. It's a great passage that some people think is about the rapture. I simply think it's about the second coming of Jesus. So let's just work through it really fast. 1 Thessalonians 4, man, it is hot in here. That's not just me, right? It's, welcome to summer. Brothers and sisters, chapter 4, verse 13, we do not want you to be uninformed or in the dark about those who sleep in death. Now, sleep is a metaphor for death in the early church. So that you do not grieve like everybody else, the rest of mankind, who have no hope. So when people die in your life that you love, and that happens a lot. We just had a guy, 29 years old, I had coffee with him yesterday, whose wife died in a longboarding accident a few weeks ago. Two little children, 18-month-old baby. So when that happens, when tragedy strikes, we don't want you to grieve like the rest of those who have no hope. Four, here's why. 14, we believe that Jesus died and rose again. So we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep with him. Meaning what happened to Jesus will happen to us. Death followed by burial, followed by resurrection. That we are going to come back from the dead. According to the Lord's word, or Jesus' teaching, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. So, This is a few years. We think that 1 Thessalonians is the earliest letter in the New Testament. So this is a few years after Jesus' resurrection. And the early church at this point is expecting Jesus' return any day. Like they're thinking, well, of course it's going to be in our lifetime. And so there are a bunch of people that are worried because they believe in the resurrection of the dead, that when Jesus comes back, there will be a resurrection, that everybody who's dead and is right now with the Lord will come back to life in a body here on earth. But they're scared, like, what about the rest of us who aren't dead? Like, do we get jacked up? Are we, like, left out in the cold? So that's the question, which is not stuff that we think about, but it was a pressing issue in Thessalonica in the first century. 4:16, the Lord himself, and here's where it gets controversial, will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Meaning those that are already dead will come out of the grave and resurrection first. After that, we who are still alive, who aren't dead yet, and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will be with the Lord forever. Therefore, encourage one another with these words. So, two ways of reading that. The rapture crew would read that literally. Remember last week we had a conversation about literal and two different ways. You can mean by literal, you mean at face value. I'm not a fan. If by literal, you mean what the original author intended to say, that's what we're getting at. So the rapture crew would read that literal in the sense of face value. Jesus comes back. We are literally caught up together, raptured up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. Now, the interesting problem with that, even if that interpretation is right, I don't think it is, but even if it's right, it has some serious flaws. One is that the presupposition here is that we're going to heaven. Where is Jesus coming in the second coming? To earth. So that's problem number one. Second problem is that resurrection in the scriptures does not mean going to heaven when you die, even though that's how a lot of Americans think of it. I just read this fascinating poll that said 2/3 of Americans who believe in resurrection don't believe we'll have a body afterwards. Yes, exactly. If you're totally confused, that just shows that 2/3 of Americans are totally confused. Resurrection is not going to heaven when you die. It's what happens after that. It's coming back to earth in a flesh and blood body. So those are the two kind of fatal flaws, in my opinion. Now, another way of reading this, the way it has been more read historically, is that this is a passage simply about Jesus coming, second coming, and that the language about the cloud and the archangel and the trumpet is all symbolic language. Clouds, as we said last week, is symbolic language for a theophany or appearing of God. A trumpet, all through the scriptures, is the way that you sound an important event. Obviously, Jesus' return is an important event. The archangel, this is kind of the end of human history. And then there's this fascinating idea of going up in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. So in the ancient world, when a king or a dignitary, but in particular a king, would come to visit a city in his kingdom, the entire city, true story, would walk outside of the gates and meet the king outside, celebrate his arrival, and then escort him back into the city to show him how it's all ready. This is what we see in the Gospel of Mark and in all four Gospels with Jesus, what's called the triumphal entry. Jesus shows up as Messiah on the donkey, you know that story, and the city of Jerusalem comes outside the gates. They lay down palm branches and clothing on the grounds, what you do for a king. They cry, Hosanna. That's a way of saying you're the Messiah. And they escort Jesus back into the city. This is what you would do for a king. So what I think, and this is how it has been more read historically, this is a beautiful Paul kind of way of saying that when Jesus, the king of the universe, comes back from heaven, we will, this is, I think, symbolic language, we'll meet him in the clouds, meaning we will be there, we will go outside the city, and then we will walk with Jesus back, and we'll say, look what we've done with the place. Like, look at what we've been doing. We've been working for justice. We have nothing to brag about, but this is the best we could do, and now would you come, and would you rule, and would you reign over this world. So rather than this passage being about all of us going away somewhere else, I think this is about Jesus coming back along with us here, resurrection, and digging into the world that we know and call home. So that's passage number one. Second one is Matthew 24, really fast, before we all die of heat stroke. Matthew 24, I'm going to keep going fast. Is that okay? Yeah. All right. And we'll do questions at the end. Matthew 24, 36 to 42. This is in Matthew's version of Mark 13. So Mark 13, what we just finished tonight, this is Matthew's version. It's twice as long and it's less confusing. All right, don't have time to read the whole thing. Let's just read kind of this paragraph here where people chat about a rapture from. So chapter 24, verse 36. But about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heavens. This is Matthew's version of what we're working on tonight. Nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark. They knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. So this is a passage about judgment. Just want to clarify that. And then here's the next part. This is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill. One will be taken. I'm sorry. I'm just reading the Bible. One will be taken and the other left. Therefore, keep watch because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. So, once again, two different ways of reading this passage. The rapture crew, of which I have friends in that world, would read this in a Star Trek kind of way. That taken here means taken away from earth to heaven. Now, does it say that? Nope, what does it say? Taken. Just taken, all right? It just says they were taken. But they would read that as taken away from earth to heaven. Now, a way to read that as the second coming of Jesus is to read this simply as a passage about judgment. In context, taken is not a good thing. You don't want to be taken. If you're there and you're with your friend and you're out working in the field, you don't want the body snatcher to come and take you away, right? If you're a first century Jew, you want Messiah to come and rule from Jerusalem over the world, okay? Now, there's all sorts of controversy, as I said tonight, about what this passage is even speaking to. And so some scholars think this is about the destruction of Jerusalem, in which case taken here would be the imagery of Titus and his invading army. Think of when Hitler and the Nazi crew blitzrig into Poland and the SS goes from house to house and people are taken, right? If you're Jewish, if you're whatever, you're taken away to a concentration camp. So that could be the imagery here. Titus is coming, two will be out in a field, one of them is taken. It's bad. Or this is a passage about second coming, which is more what I think, then this is simply saying that it's judgment, as it was in the days of Noah. People were out living it up, eating, drinking, and the next thing you know, it was the flood, and some people were safe with God, and the rest were taken in the sense of destroyed. Either way, as I read it in context, this is a passage about judgment, and taken is not a good thing. So to extrapolate out of here, this means that we are all going to be taken in the kind of beam me up, Scotty, which I just watched that movie again. It was so awesome. It's on Netflix, by the way, right now. And Benedict Cumberbatch is just awesome. So hoping he makes it into Star Wars. He will be so good. I'm just hoping for that. Anyway, so that's one way of reading it, but I don't think it's right. Now, honestly, it's basically just these two passages, and then some would argue 1 Corinthians 13 and the twinkle of an eye, that kind of thing. That one is not quite as clear. And then there's a bunch of passages where they would say it's implicit that I don't have time to get into tonight. In closing, here's why I think that the rapture is not only wrong, and there's all sorts of stuff that we think's wrong. I'm sure I'd say stuff all the time that is wrong. But I actually think it's dangerous, and here's why. In my opinion, if this is the worldview that you buy into for the future, that one day the world will just get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, and then one day you will get raptured out of here somewhere else, and then when it's all over, you'll come back, but not for that long, and then it will be the end of the time-space universe, and then you will live in heaven with Jesus forever. If that's your basic framework, if that's how you think about the future, there's some serious problems. Here's six right here. I think it's next to impossible, not impossible, but close to it, to get your heart around, first off, soteriology in the full biblical sense of the word. Soteriology is your theology of salvation. So in this frame of reference, salvation, what Jesus is up to through his death and resurrection, is essentially getting your soul into heaven when you die. And while I believe in that, I believe that is just one sliver of what Jesus is getting at through his death, burial, and resurrection, and through the atonement. I believe there is so much more that God wants to do in us, not just our soul, but our body, not just heaven, but earth, not just our future, but our present. There is so much, but I think it's really challenging to get to a full biblical theology of soteriology. Secondly, missiology. How do you have this imagery of God and his mission to put the world to rights, his relentless drive from Genesis all the way to Revelation to rescue and renew the entire cosmos from the ground up, what God has been getting at from the beginning of time, from the first bite out of the first fruit off the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's next to impossible to get to a theology of justice. You can get to a theology of serving the poor because, like, you can't get around that if you're a follower of Jesus, but justice, when you actually start getting into societal change. Like, why would you work for, you know, the change of government in the developing world if you just think, man, it's all we're doing, and I've heard this analogy before, that's rearranging the chairs on the Titanic before it goes down. I have flat out heard people say that. And so, of course, there are people who believe this that are still doing fantastic work in justice. But it's really, really easy to not do this. And then, of course, vocation. A theology that your career, what God's made you to do, that what you're doing with your life, that it matters to Jesus and his kingdom, that your vocation for the majority of you, not all of you, but for the majority of you is the primary way that you partner with Jesus, renewal of all things. How do you get there? Jimmy, you're an engineer, right? For like a paper company or whatever, right? So how do you do that with passion if you think that it's all gonna burn? I mean, what's the point? Like, then work essentially becomes make good money, tie it to the church, and tell your coworkers to go to heaven when they die. And while I'm for all three of those things, there's more. Like, what you do matters as you partner with Jesus to shape the world. It's next to impossible to get to ecology, or technically it would be called eco-theology, which is this whole calling that we have central to our humanness. The first job description that we have as human beings is to take care of the earth and take care of the animal kingdom. So when right-wing conservative Christians come along and blast people that talk about the environment or animals as liberals, that is ignoring the first chapter in the Bible and the mandate for which we were created. But it's really hard to get there, right? I was talking to, I'm not gonna call him out. Talking to a buddy of mine who was with his youth pastor when he was in high school, driving down the road, his youth pastor rolled down the window, took his McDonald's, threw it out the window. And he said, like, why are you doing that? And his youth pastor said, dude, this world's gonna pass away. Now, that's just lame. Like, most people would agree, that's just lame, whatever you believe about the future. But there is something, notice, there is a theological worldview there. And then last, humanness. This idea that your body is not something you're stuck in, but it's actually a part of who you are. It's really hard. Like, why would you care for your body? Why would you exercise? Why would you take health seriously if one day you're gonna vacate and go somewhere else? So these are some of the reasons that I think that a rapture theology is dangerous. Not to mention, I think it does dangerous things to our support of military violence. Dangerous things to blind support of Israel as a nation. I'm not really sure what all I think about the modern state of Israel, but I know that blind support is the last thing that the prophets ever gave God's people. It's the last thing they ever gave. I met a family when I was in Israel who was over there, and they were so proud of themselves, and they were so sweet. These were not bad people. These were kind, nice people. And they were so proud. They were over in Israel taking 2 weeks vacation. There was some name for it, I don't remember. Serving on an Israeli military base, washing tanks as their ministry for Jesus. So this is a worldview where Jesus, your rabbi, who said, love your enemies, bless those who persecute you, do good to those. You, in this worldview, there are people that go over and wash tanks to kill Palestinians. Way more Palestinians who follow Jesus than Jews, by the way. Barely any Jews follow Jesus. Tons of Palestinians love Jesus of Nazareth. You're washing tanks in the name of Jesus. Like, at that point, in my opinion, something in your theology is not right, all right? So in my mind, there's dangerous stuff this does to the environment and justice and your vocation and the mission of God and what it means to be saved and your view of military violence and all of that stuff. Now, that said, whether you fully agree with me or fully disagree with me or you're just confused, here's the point. There are four things when it comes to the future that are crystal clear that 99% of followers of Jesus all agree on. And in my opinion, this is where our focus should be. This is where all of our focus as a church is. First off, Jesus comes back. How many of you believe that? Yep, he's coming back. He's coming back where? Here, then, resurrection. This is central, the earliest church creed. I believe in the resurrection of the body. Your body, not just your soul, your body will come back to life at Jesus' power. Judgment. Jesus will set everything straight. The righteous and the wicked will all stand in front of God. You, your coworker, your mom, your dad, all of us. We will all stand in front of God. Some of us will rise to eternal life and others, tragically, will rise to destruction. And then last, whatever you want to call it, new creation is what it's called in theology, but God will recreate the heavens and the earth. This much is crystal clear. Like, this is basically what 99.9% of followers of Jesus, Eastern, Western, dispensationalist, not dispensationalist, confused, Calvinist, Arminian, everybody says, yep, Jesus comes back, resurrection, judgment, new creation. And in my opinion, this is where we need to live and freight and dream and pray and work towards. And this is what our emphasis needs to be on. In closing, a couple of resources, if you're curious. The best book I know at all on eschatology is Surprised by Hope by my hero, N.T. Wright. This book literally changed my life a while ago. Surprised by Hope by N.T. Wright is fantastic. For those of you that are curious about Revelation, I don't have time to get into that tonight. There's a great, not that long, paperback read by Richard Bauckham, who's one of the best scholars we have out of St. Andrews in Scotland. It's called The Theology of Revelation. I'm still not really sure what I think about Revelation, but I know this book is fantastic. If you want to think about another way to read Revelation other than this, if you grew up with it. And then if you want a series, and I'm always a little hesitant to suggest him because he's controversial, but Greg Boyd, who I disagree with a ton of his stuff, I'm not an open theist, but he has some fascinating things to say. He just did a 7-part series called Rescuing Revelation. I'm not all the way through it, so I can't vouch for all of it, so I probably shouldn't be putting it up on this board. But what I've heard so far is the best thing I've heard yet on Revelation, if you're curious. There it is.